How do you like your glass? Half empty or half full? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 26th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are some economic indicators that you can really wrap your brain around, right? The unemployment rate, for instance, or the number of new homes built in a given month. Both of those are tangible, easily understood for the most part. Sometimes, though, you get a report that, while interesting and informative, is also a bit squishy. Like the one we got today, something called the Consumer Confidence Index. I could give you the number, but it's probably not going to mean anything to you. 125.5. See what I mean? It's pretty strong, actually, and historically, but it's also the fourth month straight that consumer confidence has gone down. The question really, though, especially important given how critical consumers are to this economy at this moment, is what exactly consumer confidence is. Anyway, Marketplace's Sabri Benishor starts us off.
Feelings. Consumer confidence is feelings about the economy.
It could be better.
We're due for some kind of recession of some sort.
It's a little flat right now.
Mariel Mervichin, Brian Sarfo, Chris Chirone, New Yorkers, all sharing their views with Marketplace. There are a few different folks who do official monthly consumer confidence surveys. The Conference Board is one.
So we ask consumers five questions, which we've been doing since the late 60s.
Lynn Franco is Senior Director of Economic Indicators. First, they ask people, about 2,600 of them via mail, how they feel about the way things are now.
You know, are jobs plentiful, not so plentiful, hard to get?
And then surveys will ask, how do people feel about the economy in the future? 6 months, 12 months?
In terms of employment, do they expect more jobs, fewer jobs, or the same? And in terms of their income, do they expect it to increase, decrease, or remain the same?
People's answers are a window onto what's on their mind. And all the answers are used to pop out a number. Voila, consumer confidence. And of course, we care about all this because feelings can turn into dollars or lack of dollars. Richard Curtin is director of surveys for the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, another measure of consumer confidence.
When people become optimistic, they're more likely to make discretionary spending decisions. And when they're pessimistic, they're more likely to put off those decisions.
And the worse consumers think the future will be, and the longer they feel that way,
the more likely it is that we're headed for a recession.
Constance Hunter, chief economist at KPMG. All of this is to say,
feelings are really important.
Even to economists. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You know who's reasonably confident and is not an economist, by the way? Jay Powell, that's who. The Fed chair gave a speech last night, the Greater Providence, Rhode Island Chamber of Commerce, should you be curious. He talked about all the usual stuff, inflation, the economic expansion reaching all Americans, and he said that that expansion is at a point now where he sees the glass as, and these are his words, much more than half full. So we got some actual economists on the phone to tease out what Mr. Powell might have been talking about.
So what's really more than half full are the employment gains. This is the unemployment rate is near the lows of the last 50 years.
3.6%, as you know, if you listen to this radio program regularly. Nellie Lang is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution talking about what is really item one when it comes to the economic glass, employment, where a lot of the gains have been coming from what are called prime age workers, 25 to 54-year-olds.
It's been on a downward trend for several decades, intensified after the financial crisis. But since about 2014-15, it has started to rise.
And it's not just the number of people who are employed. Wages are finally up as well.
There have been income gains and wealth gains for middle-income families.
Item two in the economic glass, inflation. Nice, steady inflation.
So that also is part of the more than half full for a central bank who has a mandate for maximum employment and price stability.
But because, remember, the glass is only half full.
It's not totally full because of the fact that inflation remains subdued.
Narayana Kochalakota teaches at the University of Rochester, used to run the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, by the way. So subdued, Mr. Kochalakota, means what?
Below the Fed's desired level of 2%.
All right, good to know. One more thing, by the way, in the only half-full category, those income gains Nellie Lang was talking about, they are not equally distributed in this economy.
The lower income is just moving up more modestly than for middle income. So I think there's still room for that to continue to grow, and that would make the economy even stronger.
Or, to torture the metaphor just a little bit longer, fill the Fed chair's economic glass a little bit more. How Wall Street took Mr. Powell's speech when we do the numbers. Unpaid labor is the subject of this next story. Domestic labor, to be clear, cooking, cleaning, caregiving as well, way more of which is done by women than by men. It's not as bad now as it has been historically, that gender gap, but it is one of the reasons women participate in the workforce at a lower rate than men do. And it's a disparity that's already the reality for young women between the ages of 16 and 24. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story.
Like a lot of children of immigrants, 26-year-old Lisbeth Rivas Ruiz had to grow up fast. Her parents worked long hours in the vegetable fields and Christmas tree farms of Oregon's Willamette Valley, and they didn't speak much English.
As early as middle school, they started saying, like, oh, well, you know the language better than we do. Hey, can you make this phone call for the doctors? Come with me to the doctor's appointment. Hey, what does this paper say? We're trying to buy a house.
Her parents, who came from Mexico, worked full-time, sometimes split shifts. There were layoffs, and money was often tight. A brother came along, then a little sister, 6 and 10 years younger than Lisbeth. Her parents couldn't afford childcare, so it fell to her.
I'm not the oldest, but I am the oldest girl. And so, as a cultural background in that, you're expected to do certain things, you know, look out after your siblings, take them to school early in the mornings, help with their homework, mopping, cleaning, just doing chores around the house.
Lisbeth's family and their two chihuahuas gathered in the kitchen of the ranch house they've owned for nearly 20 years in Corvallis, Oregon. Her mom, Adela, now works as a custodian cleaning dorm rooms at Oregon State University. As pozole simmered on the stove, Adela said she wishes she hadn't had to leave Lisbeth in charge so much.
When I worked night shift, it was really hard to do because I had to leave Lisbeth watching her younger brother and sister. But I couldn't do anything else. I had to earn money to support them and not let them down.
Homework came after housework for Lisbeth. That didn't leave time for an after-school job or other activities.
I loved sports growing up, but as I grew up and the demands were higher, just at home, there's not a lot of opportunity to play a sport.
On average, teenage girls have less time than boys for homework, extracurriculars, and after-school jobs, in part because they spend 30 to 45 minutes more a day on unpaid caregiving and household chores. That's according to a recent report from the Brookings Institution's Hamilton Project. This can lead to lower educational attainment and earning power. But it didn't for Lisbeth Rivas Ruiz. She got good grades in high school and went on to the University of Oregon on a full scholarship.
All the things that you have to do, translate, help with the kids. And so I was kind of like, no, like I need an escape. And that was my escape. It was a good escape because it got me further, but it wasn't easy.
Things are a good deal easier for her sister, Yesenia. She's now 16, a junior in high school. The family's better off economically. The parents are about to pay off their mortgage. Yesenia's got fewer chores and no younger siblings to take care of. And she's planning to follow her big sister's example and go to college.
I just mostly focus on my schoolwork and all that. What I really like to do is dancing, traditional Mexican dancing.
But not every family's doing as well as the Rivas Ruiz's. The Hamilton Project study found that around 1 in 10 teenagers isn't in school or working. Lisbeth sees the problems they face every day in her job. She's an alcohol and drug addiction counselor at a Latin American community organization working with young adults and families.
Dealing with substance use, maybe both parents being one parent. And then if you put in language barriers, low income, whether that is, hey, I have to stay home because I have to babysit, like literally stay home. I can't go to school.
The Hamilton Project finds that teenage girls who are neither working nor in school spend around 20 hours a week doing unpaid household labor, three times as much as boys. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The housing market in this economy continues to be reasonably strong. Prices are up and homes are selling. People are finding places to buy and the money to buy them with. But sometimes, as you'll hear in this next episode of our series Adventures in Housing, sometimes a house isn't the best investment you can make.
My name is Zarish Khan and I live in Iowa City. So I grew up in Pakistan, and mortgage is not available over there generally to people. So to really own a home, you have to save up the whole entire amount of your house cost upfront in cash. And that's what my mom did. That's what my grandparents did. So having a home, a house of your own, was a huge goal for my family. I'm one of those poster children for the American dream who come here to make a bigger, better life for themselves and for their kids. And the only reason I've been able to do it is because I invested time, money, energy on education, and my family did that. In the fall of 2018, I had finally reached a point in my life where I felt I needed to own that dream home. I found this place that was everything that you could have asked for. It was very close to downtown, big backyard. Really, I walked into that home and I could feel that this was going to be my home. I made an offer. The offer got accepted. At that point, I was really thinking about how I was going to make it my own, how I was going to put my sofa there and my reading nook would be here and the kids' play area would be there. When the news came that my cousin had passed away, he was 31 years old, newly married with a one-year-old daughter. And that just made the tragedy a whole lot more worse. I felt very overwhelmed. There I was standing in my dream house. The dream was almost about to become a reality. And yet I heard this tragic news. And I felt that something had to be done. So I took the check that I was going to use as a down payment for my house. I took that check and I set up an educational fund for Misha, my cousin's daughter. I felt, you know, the best way to honor his memory was to ensure that this girl who suddenly had fewer opportunities in life to educate herself is at least covered as far as the education is concerned. As a doctor, I see the bad side of life a lot. I see death, I see sickness, I see disease, I see how people, you know, more than what I've learned is how people grieve, how people give up, how people respond to situations. It kind of matures you as a person as well. So while it was a sad moment to say, okay, nope, this one's not for me, my dream lives on, and I started saving again for my own home.
Zarish Khan is a doctor in Iowa City, Iowa. Do us a favor, would you? Tell us about your adventure or adventures, if you've had more than one, in housing. You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
These cartels have shown an amazing ability to diversify. That's why they're in the avocado business to begin with.
Green gold, they call it. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials found 55 points in the couch cushions today, 0.2%, 28,121. The NASDAQ ticked up 15 points, just under 0.2%, 86.47. The S&P 500 lifted 6 points, 0.2% there as well, 31.40 on that index. Best Buy posted strong results for its latest quarter and said some upbeat things about its outlook for profits. Shares thus up 9.8% today. Dick's Sporting Goods did better in its latest quarter than anybody had been guessing. Sales up, full year guidance up as well. Shares up 18.6%. We had Ed Stack on the program not too long ago, by the way, the son of and the current CEO of that company. You can find it, obviously, at marketplace.org. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about tariffs a little bit yesterday on the program, specifically who's paying them. That would be, says the New York Fed and many, many others, American importers and consumers. And that brings us to this morning's earnings report from Dollar Tree. Sales up, profits up. Also up, tariff costs, says the company. An extra $19 million next quarter if the next round of import taxes goes into effect next month as scheduled. It's a tricky situation for a company whose rock-bottom prices are its brand, as Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
Walk down the aisles of a Dollar Tree, and you'll see lots of things the Trump administration has hit with import taxes.
Beads and costume jewelry, a lot of kitchenware and tableware, cleaning supplies, pens, pencils, markers.
That's Catherine Russ, an economics professor at UC Davis. Stores like Walmart or Home Depot sell a broader range of goods, and those stores can absorb tariffs by increasing prices on more expensive items. Russ says Dollar Tree doesn't have that luxury. After all, customers shop there because almost everything costs a dollar.
The market for these is going to be very highly sensitive to price, so price increases may end up really changing their volume of sales.
Earlier this year, Dollar Tree started experimenting with higher prices, with sections it calls Dollar Tree Plus. Still, it's called Dollar Tree. That price point isn't likely to go away. So the company's trying to cut costs, too. Here's Dollar Tree CEO Gary Philbin on CNBC this morning.
We negotiate lower costs. It's just as simple as sometimes meeting face-to-face with our vendors. We are moving some product out of China. We're sourcing it elsewhere. We are redesigning product.
Target recently demanded that its suppliers pick up the cost of tariffs. But Dollar Tree doesn't have as much weight to throw around, says Ishwar Prasad, a trade policy professor at Cornell.
For a low-margin retail merchant, the bargaining power with Chinese suppliers is probably very limited.
Prasad says Dollar Tree suppliers have low margins themselves, because what they sell is so cheap. That doesn't give them much room to absorb tariffs either. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There is a line to be had here about there being a secondary market in everything, but it's not coming to me right now. So I'll just tell you that eBay is going to sell ticket broker StubHub to its European competitor Viagogo for about $4 billion. eBay is best known for its online auctions, of course, and it's been under some pressure from activist investors to sell off some of the miscellany and refocus on its core business in the face of slowing growth. So what exactly is eBay's core business right now anyway? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
10 years ago, Kunle Lawrence was always on eBay to buy shoes, clothing, and electronics. But in recent years, the attorney in Durham, North Carolina, has drifted away.
There's just other options with faster delivery and less hassle.
Like Amazon, Lawrence's new go-to site. But once, eBay was on the same footing as the e-commerce behemoth, says Scott Galloway, a marketing professor at NYU.
You could look at it as a company that has stood still in time since 2004.
Back then, shoppers went online to find niche and collectible items, which is where eBay excelled. But e-commerce is now mainstream. Galloway says eBay shifted away from auctions to more new items with fixed prices, but it isn't able to compete.
The war for general e-commerce is over.
And Amazon won. But even for auctions, eBay now has more competition. Isabel Martin, a costumer for a theater company in Louisville, Kentucky, buys a lot of secondhand clothes online.
Which in the past few years has meant more and more apps like Poshmark and Mercari.
Which she says are easier to use to communicate with sellers and find exactly what she's looking for. The outdated interface of eBay could be holding it back in a mobile shopping era, says John Freeman, an investment advisor at CFRA.
It's a very busy, cluttered site. It's not very good for browsing.
He says improving the layout and the algorithms that display suggested products could make eBay a better shopping destination, even if it won't ever again be the one-stop shop for everything. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Here's something to think about the next time you're at the grocery store trying to find a ripe avocado. Narco-trafficking. Seriously. We now eat so many avocados in this economy, the overwhelming majority of which come from Mexico, that demand like that and the value of the crop has given rise to extortion and hijacking cartels and worse. Kate Linthicum is a foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's based in Mexico City, wrote about this recently. Kate, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
One of the things you point out in this piece is the only way I can think of to describe it is the corporate structure. You know, when you were talking about narco trafficking in this article, it was big international conglomerates with supply chains and logistics and all of that. These gangs and cartels going after avocado farms are much more small local businesses.
Yeah, well, think about how difficult it is really to traffic drugs on a large scale. You're in Mexico, you have to have contacts in South America, for example. If you're importing cocaine, you have to have control of the port in Mexico where that cocaine arrives. You have to have contacts with dealers in the U.S. who actually get these drugs to the customers. And these smaller groups that have emerged, they don't have all those contacts necessarily. So they look for money wherever they can get it. And in this stretch of the country, it's produce, and specifically avocados.
And the barriers to entry, I imagine, are pretty low. You need some trucks to deal with this stolen produce and some guns.
Right. And guns are pretty easy to secure here because, you know, 250 of them are estimated to be coming from the U.S. each day illegally. And you can hijack a truck if you don't have one. That's what we're seeing, 4 trucks hijacked every day in this state.
So there's extortion and protection money that farmers have to pay. What do you hear from the workers who are actually up in the trees harvesting this fruit?
Yeah, so this problem has really affected everybody in the production line. So you do have the grove owners who are having to pay extortion, often to multiple groups. And then on down the line, you have drivers who are being targeted. And then you have the pickers themselves who say they're forced at gunpoint to go to these cartel-controlled farms and pick avocados for them. Hmm. It's really good money by Mexican standards. A picker makes, you know, $75 a day. Wow. Compared to the $5 minimum wage across Mexico. But it's increasingly pretty dangerous work, too.
It is totally fascinating, and I will tell you, completely depressing this story is. How much of what's going on down there is demand from the United States? We are eating, you say in this story, an unbelievable amount of Mexican avocados.
Right, yeah. The vast majority of avocados consumed in the U.S. are from Mexico, from the state of Michoacán. I've had people ask me in recent days, like, should we be boycotting avocados from Mexico? That would probably hurt this region more than it would help it. These cartels have shown an amazing ability to diversify. That's why they're in the avocado business to begin with. They were originally drug trafficking groups that have broken down and looked for business elsewhere. So I don't think that a boycott is necessarily the answer.
So what's the solution? What's the answer, right? I mean, you talk about government inability to control the violence. You've talked about government inability to control the extortion and the actual practice of this kind of trafficking. What's the answer?
Not a simple question.
Yeah.
Not easy answers. But López Obrador, the current Mexican president, you know, was elected on a platform of pledging to change this. He said, we are no longer at war with the cartels. You know, he's created a bunch of social programs that he says in time will make it so people don't want to join drug cartels. But those are very long-term strategies. And in the short term, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a few extremely violent events in Mexico that have shook people. And López Obrador's popularity has fallen 10 points in just a couple of months. He said very clearly what he's not going to do, but he hasn't exactly said what he plans to do instead.
Kate Linthicum, in Mexico City for the Los Angeles Times, writing about the avocado trade. It's kind of amazing. Kate, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.
This final note on the way out today, about which I am frankly appalled. It is now possible through the U.S. offices of the British bookmaker William Hill to get point spreads on Thanksgiving family football games. The Associated Press had the story. Somebody on your team drunk or hungover, perhaps? You get 2 points for that. You got a player taller than 6 feet? You give 1.5 for that. Also to be considered, whether anybody ran a turkey trot race earlier in the day and is fatigued, and whether anybody was a college athlete. I mean, yes, tongue-in-cheek, but still, you can hear the arguments, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 all up, give or take 0.2%. Today, our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.